Welcome to the Friday Workplace Briefing. Workplace law changes so quickly. Tune in weekly to find out how the law is changing and what you need to do. Your hosts are Andrew Douglas, Managing Principal, FCW Lawyers, and Karen Liu, Principal Consultant, Found Consulting.
Good morning, how are you? Now, Karen is meant to be with us, and as you can see, she's not there today. She's actually sitting outside a hospital waiting for a small procedure. So to Karen, best wishes and take care. Today, it's just going to be me. It's the first day of lockdown in Victoria, so we thought rather than try and get our staff to be engaged, it'd just be me for the day. One of the questions that came out last week was, what do we actually do around health information and COVID? So I thought, just as a bit of a beginning, let's have a bit of a chat about what that is. Obviously, safety legislation says we've got to provide a safe working environment. That means any information that we have around someone's health that could affect that safe environment, not only we're entitled to ask, we're required to ask to ensure we have a safe workplace, and we're obliged to monitor people's health, part of safety law. So although there's a lot of noise around what we do around COVID, the answer is mandatory check-ins, ensuring people are safe, having a policy and a process that actually sits around COVID is critical at the moment. It's not something you can think about doing, it's something you must do. So thank you for the question that came up last week about that. We've got quite a lot on today. Got some interesting things, some work Karen's done around CEOs. And can I just say, we sent out a survey to the CEOs in our group and had an overwhelming response back. And so thank you very much for all of those people for doing it. That will actually turn into a quite substantial report, I think of 5 or 6 pages, which we will send out to you in the next week or so, which actually looks at the impact of COVID and the changes, the major changes during this time. I'll talk about that a little bit later. All right, let's kick off with the case. It's very hard without having Karen, and the koala's just not cutting it today at all, I'm afraid. So we'll just have to see how we go. The first case I want to talk to you is a case called Michael Nazar and Mondelez Australia. And it really raises probably not one of the greatest decisions that's come out, but it deals with one of the most interesting issues. The first issue is this: can I put people on successive maximum term contracts? Now, let's be really clear, what is a maximum term contract and what is a fixed term contract? Because they're often misunderstood. And both of them have a capacity to exclude the operation of the unfair dismissal regime, but in slightly different ways. A fixed term contract has no capacity to terminate that contract during the life of it. And it will exclude the unfair dismissal regime when the person gets to the end of that time. It's called the effluxion of time. There is no right to say that they have permanent employment. I hope that's really clear. That's what a fixed term contract is. But the legislation also contemplates what's called a maximum term contract, which does have the capacity to terminate during the life of the contract, but is very, very clear that it deals with an employment for a fixed time and at which there is no further employment. And in the Mondelez case, there's a really interesting discussion about it, because an employee started off as labour hire, then went on to eight successive maximum term contracts. So they were terminable before. The key things that Mondelez did is they made it very clear in the maximum term contract. And that's why when you do these, I want you to talk to us, okay? I don't want you to muck it up, because there is specific language in a maximum term contract that evades the unfair dismissal regime when the contract comes to an end. But the process goes like this. When you sit down with someone, you say, look, at the moment we only have 3 months' work, so I'm offering you a maximum term contract for those 3 months, and that is all the employment period is for. And the contract must reflect that in it, both in its recitals, which is the evidence provision. So when you have a contract, you often see a heading background or recitals. What that does is it creates evidence for you of what is the intent of the document. Now, I've just got a question here. What obligation is there for an employer to remind an employee on a fixed-term contract? I'll come to it. Thank you very much. So you've told the person before they enter into what it is. You've made it very clear the person reads and understands it. And you advise them, as this question goes, as you're coming along, what is the future of work likely to be? And if this comes to an end, is it likely to conclude? And certainly not on the last day do you say goodbye. In the week or two beforehand, you say, look, it's unlikely that there'll be another maximum term contract. Now, this case law is based on a full bench decision. I think it'll stand up because of the method in which the commissioner did it. It's not a great decision, but what it does focus on is the clarity at the beginning, before the person enters into it, and the use of the language, there is specific language in a maximum term contract. It's not just taking a fixed term contract or a permanent contract and amending it slightly. There is a substantial language difference that must be deployed. So look, that's really interesting, okay? And I think for all of us, given times of great uncertainty, there are very good reasons for using maximum term contracts now, and we should be using a lot more of them to manage the volatility in the workplace rather than trying to use casuals or part-times. And these are good ideas to have flexible working. The next thing that's happened, and it's not new for a number of other states, so if we look at New South Wales, Queensland, the ACT and Northern Territory, a WorkSafe inspector is able to come and issue fines, infringement fines. They range in the different jurisdictions for a company of $3,000 plus down to what's happening in Victoria, which is around about $1,807 is the maximum one of those. And for an individual, I think it's around about $360. But the importance of these fines is really important. One, they are relevant evidence. So this comes in on the 20th of July in Victoria, that an inspector can turn up on the site, check for licences, qualifications, adequate supervision. There's a number of bits and pieces, and Nina will send out an article on it to be clear. But this gives the inspector the power to immediately create liability in the organisation. Why is that important? Because the moment an infringement notice is issued, the officers are on notice of a failure within the organisation. Therefore, if a serious incident or death arises later on that goes to that incident for which a fine has been given, the officers are exposed. Now, do you see why it's so important? I want people to understand, push back. If this is wrong, push back. Just like when someone comes in, an inspector comes in and issues an improvement notice. Don't just accept it. Understand it immediately creates this liability and risk that sits around it. And as we've talked to you about improvement notices before, commonly the diagnosis that's given and the treatment offered by the inspector is way above what is reasonably practical. But if you accept it and something goes wrong, then you have liability, not just for the organisation, but for the officers. So this regime starts on the 20th of July in Victoria. Similar provisions exist in the other four states and territories I've talked about. The importance of it is not that it's just a small infringement notice. It is the upward risk that comes with it, okay? And again, it raises the thing of having good relationships with inspectors so that we don't end up with them being angry and just issuing notices to punish you because you don't listen and engage with them. Next case, and we've talked about some of these cases before, Ford and Comcare is a fascinating case. It's one that's an AAT case, an appeals tribunal case, dealing with workers' compensation about in the course of employment. And one of the issues that arises since all travel elements of workers' compensation, where every state and territory got rid of them so that you can't get a workers' comp claim as you're driving to and from work, is, well, what happens when you're in a building and you're in the foyer of that building and you trip over and hurt yourself, but it is the building that you will ultimately work in. So it's a public space, the building you ultimately work at. And what Ford and Comcare found is very simple. In this case, Ford had access to an area which was both private to the organisation but also public, and the incident that occurred where they hurt themselves happened in the public space. And the regulator said, well, it doesn't arise out of the course of employment. It's a public space like any other public space. A public space could be a street outside. It's definitely not compensable. We've talked before about hazardous and cases like that that talk about if it is a reasonable expectation, if it would reasonably be expected that you need to do this for the purpose of work, then it will be compensable. And we've talked about that mainly in drinking cases, in retreats, you know, where people go away on a retreat and they injure themselves at night. But there's no doubt that hazardous as a case, a High Court case, also applies to when you are in a building, when you're doing something, you're driving for the purposes of work. All those things are work-related. It might be even that you're catching a bus between different offices. That's still for the purposes of work, okay? So Ness has done a really good article with Kim on this, which will come out. And I must say there is a great article that's published on the website, and Soph can probably tell me whether it's up now or not, which we promised a few weeks ago about out-of-work injuries and how that affects workplace law and out-of-work criminality and how that affects. So that article is probably up on the website now. If it's not up, it'll be up there very shortly. But Ford and Comcare is a really important case for us to understand that we must educate our employees about what is work and what are our expectations. This was a falling case, so this is one that's hard to educate. but it's very common that people go out for a lunch with clients. There's a whole lot of circumstances that arise out of the course of work. And I want you to be aware of that. I want your policies and procedures to reflect that. And I want the education of your employees to comprehend that as well. And the classic examples that we're dealing with currently are cases where employees go out to lunch with a client and the client sexually harasses one of the staff members, clearly in the course of work. Sexual harassment, for safety law, for workers' compensation, all right? So if you've got that difficult client, don't place people who are vulnerable near them, for instance. So there's some of the learnings that come. It's a really interesting, good case, and Nessa's article is a terrific article, and that should be up on the website later next week. Now, normally we're coming to Karen's Corner, but as you've seen, the koala is relatively quiet today. It hasn't said a lot. But what Karen did do over the week is to send out a sort of information-rich survey to all the CEOs that businesses we act for. I must say I wasn't expecting a fantastic return because it involved 10 to 15 minutes of their dedicated time to respond to it. But we did get a terrific response rate and a really quite overwhelming response rate. And there's some bits of information that I want to tell you that came out of that. So I think what we understood from this is CEOs have really, really struggled during this time. They've found a very significant impact. Some of the information that we got from CEOs was that they needed to pay very deliberate attention to what the changes were upon them. We got a really strong sense of selflessness from the CEOs. So I know that the CEOs come in for a bit of criticism at time, but they have a really employee-focused response from the people we got. Now, I don't think that's just because the sample was small, because the sample was extraordinarily high. We found also that for them, part of the ways they did things to relax was to deliberately carve out time for themselves, to focus on health-related behaviours for themselves around exercise, around what they ate, around sleep. Some very good lessons. These are some of the brightest people in our working environments, and they realised to look after other people, they had to look after themselves. So that report, and I've seen a first draft of it, is around about 5 or 6 pages. It'll be coming out to all of you in the next 4 or 5 days, I hope, subject to what COVID's done to the way we get information out. What we're going to take from this is a couple of things, and it's one of the themes that came out of this is how do we as organisation manage change? And what I wanted to chat to you today to support what Karen was talking about is an author called Peter Frost. I'm more than happy to share with you. I think Peter Frost's book is Toxic Emotions at Work, and he also has a very good Harvard Business Review article which is written by him and Sandra Robinson in July, August 1999, called Toxic Handler, Organisational Help and Helper and Casualty. Now, what Peter Frost did is he was an academic in business and he'd always written about what drives productivity. So he was a classic person who worked in that sort of space. He ended up having to go to hospital for a cancer scare and he watched how nurses received treatment from other people, bad treatment from other people. And he could see the impact it was actually having on them. In conversations with them, they discussed how difficult that was. And he came up with this concept of what is what he describes a toxic handler. Now, there's been a lot of movement from Peter Frost's original book, and people probably wouldn't use the word toxic anymore because it's not particularly fashionable. But what he said is that all organisations have, quite informally, people who listen empathetically, they suggest solutions, they work behind the scenes to prevent pain and harm to people. They carry the confidences of people with them and they reframe difficult messages. Now, as I was thinking about what is a toxic handler and as I chatted to this with Karen, we thought, actually, that is the life of most HR managers and most OHS managers. They're often caught between a business imperative and trying to frame it in a way which is fair and reasonable to an employee, explaining what is the business case and then providing a feedback back up through the loop as to how that should be managed. Change management is inclined to be very lumpy because change is happening very, very fast these days. It's not like you can plot a complete change management strategy because everything changes all the time. What Frost's thesis is you must understand that these people live and exist and sustain an organisation. Without them, the organisations fall apart. But it doesn't have to be quite that way if we acknowledge there is this need for greater empathy in the way that we treat people and if we consult much more deeply about how we do things so that people feel engaged and listened to. So I'd love you to read what Peter Frost says, but what we want to do is come back to you in a couple of weeks' time to talk to all of you about what is the impact of change upon you. Not COVID so much, but COVID is an exemplar, isn't it? We look at COVID and we go, it just, things change so rapidly. I've seen our CEO send out, our CEO and CEO send out messages in the last day, compassionate, generous, informative and supportive about, well, we've now got our Sydney office in lockdown and been there for a long time. What does it mean for them? And now we've got our Melbourne office thrown in to lockdown just when we were getting our feet back in the water and enjoying that physical camaraderie of being together. So the messaging around what you can do and what you can't do is pretty important, isn't it? Because it's the fifth time in Melbourne. Making people feel that they have a say, making them understand their health is a priority, falls back to the leaders in the group to manage those issues. So if we can think of this idea of a toxic handler, and that's really why we started this discussion with CEOs to find out, well, what is the impact on them? And what we found out, it is a very significant impact on them. It changes their lives. They have trouble shedding the level of stress they feel as they manage that change. So what we're going to do is come back, not this week, but in the weeks that come, provide a questionnaire that goes out to all of you who are listening, and particularly focus on our HR and OHS people and our workers' compensation people who are on the front line of managing difficult behaviours, and find out how it impacts them. Because what we want to do from there is go to the next stage of saying, well, why does it have to be like that? Why can't we have compassionate leadership? Why is it that these people who interpret and translate business change are constantly the ones who are caught in between and are being damaged by it? Because what it really calls upon all leaders to do this, what is our purpose? What are we doing? What are the values that drive the organisation? How do we lead those? But most importantly, how do we listen rather than just act? Australian businesses are not great at listening. They're terrific at acting, and it's inclined to be top-down acting. And what happens is they just get it done and then they work out how to fix it as they go along. And I think what we've seen from COVID more than we've ever seen before is if you lead in that manner, you harm people. And the harm is insidious. It's not someone losing a leg. It's a gradual degradation in the person's self-esteem and well-being, which ultimately leads to them developing mental health issues. And for us as a business, ultimately leads to workers' compensation claim, conflicts, loss of productivity, quality, client damage. So I know this seems like a very discreet discussion. We're spending quite a lot of time on it, and it would be much more fun and more informative if Karen rather than the koala was here helping me through that discussion. But to me, it goes to the very heart of what we do in workplace law and what you do as leaders. How is it that we lead so that all of us are preventing toxic behaviours, so we're not having toxic behaviours, so they're not impacting leaders in the way they do, and that we're actually getting clarity? So, look, let's start that discussion a bit next week, roll into the survey, and we'll come out with a very detailed report, which, again, I think the idea of these reports is they give you a conversation piece based on reliable evidence of a significant sample that you can take back to the workplace. Remember, this isn't two or three people responding. This was over a third of all the CEOs of all of our organisation who responded. What a fantastic sample. They come from every industry, health, financial services, professional services. So it's a real cross-section. It is a genuine and significant sample, and what comes out of it is very similar across all groups. So let's do the same again and let's see what those lessons are, and again, take it back to engage in change with our organisation. Now, so I think what we might do is go to our problem this week, a very discreet problem this week. All right, Kyle was a butcher at Big Bones Butcher in Chadstone Shopping Centre. He started work at 5 a.m. Monday to Friday, finishing at 4 p.m. On Friday, 9 July 2021, he was returning from his lunch break and went to the general staff toilet, available for all staff at Chadstone. His break was due to finish in 7 minutes. As he walked out of the bathroom into the public passageway, back into the shopping centre proper, he bumped into his boss, Trevor. Trevor was in a bad mood. He demanded to know what Kyle was doing, taking a break from work, adding that he is always disappearing to the toilet to get out of work. Trevor had made many comments in front of others to Kyle about his attendance at work issues. Kyle had a hot temper and, rather than explain he was on a meal break, told Trevor to off and pushed him out of his way. Trevor responded by pushing him back so hard he fell against the wall, hitting his head. The impact knocked Kyle out and he fell to the floor, actually flaw there is my spelling mistake. That's not promotional flaw, F-L-A-W. It's flaw, F-L-O-O-R. Sorry about that. Dislocating his right shoulder and becoming concussed. And I've missed out the ED on that as well. So you can see that was a late night job. Let's go to the poll. Okay, was Kyle's physical injuries compensable under workers' comp claim? The answer is really Ford and Comcare say that if it arises out or in the course of employment, then it is compensable. This was during a meal break. Okay, it was a meal break which was permitted under an award, and they were in a building doing something which would be reasonable to do under a meal break, which is go to the bathroom. So I think the answer is very clearly it would be compensable. The real question is whether the violence that was committed by Kyle could in any way affect that, and the answer is no, it wouldn't. It would still be compensable. Could Trevor and Big Bone Butcher be prosecuted under occupational health and safety law? Well, let's talk about what the primary obligations are, but let's elevate it a little bit to see where we end up. There is no doubt that what Trevor did is a hazard. So it's a hazard. Don't even get to the risk part. It's a hazard because there's no control over the risk and he injured somebody. So it was reasonably practical for him not to do it, and he did it, and he caused an injury, so he made an unsafe working environment. So it is a general breach, but, of course, the general breach is against the company itself. The question is then whether there can be a liability that falls directly against Trevor. What do you think about reckless endangerment? Okay, it's a go-to-jail thing, but what we have to show in reckless endangerment is very, very simple. We have to show that he was careless as to the risk and caused serious injury. That's all we have to show. That's it. So I think Trevor's in real strife, okay? And if Trevor is an officer of the organisation, it is common assault. You're absolutely right, Peter. So it's also a criminal offence. There's no doubt about that as well. But the issue here is whether it's prosecutable under OHS law. And the thing that I think makes this more insidious and could be prosecuted under OHS law is you could capture all the bullying that occurred beforehand. So the repeated discussing in front of other people, making the work environment unsafe, culminating in an assault, are matters which could be collectively particularised under a general breach. And there is some risk for Trevor, personally, of reckless endangerment. But I think, as has been raised, the probable outcome of this is Trevor faces police proceedings for common assault. But I'm raising this with you because it is open under OHS legislation to deal with it. Okay? And there's absolutely no doubt that the organisation, by Trevor being within the organisation, and what I was trying to get to is you normally can't say outside of work is a workplace. But because of what occurred and the manner in which it occurred, it would be a workplace for the purpose of OHS. Isn't that interesting? Because normally that wouldn't be a workplace under OH law. And remember, workplace has a different meaning under safety law. It actually has to be a place where work is being carried out, okay? Employer and employee, work carried out. Workers' compensation, it has a definition which is arising out of or in the course of employment. Different definition to safety law. And, of course, employment law is very, very broad following Rose and Telstra decision. So there are three different types of workplace that exist based on the type of law. And discrimination law, I might add, sits with employment law and Rose and Telstra out in that far category. So I just want you to know the definition of workplace is not common. But because of the nature of what occurred with the people that occurred and it related to work, it would be a workplace for safety law, okay? Now, the last question is, Kyle said he felt unsafe to return to work and had a stress claim accepted. His sole issue was Trevor. Trevor was sent to work at the High Point shop, but Kyle refused to go back to work, saying he still felt unsafe. Can a stress claim be terminated? Now, all of you sit a bit all over the place on this, and so you should. Remember, the claim has been accepted, so all that can happen now is the claim be terminated. And the issue in workers' compensation is about a person's capacity. It's not about their illness. That's a misconception that sits in workers' compensation always. If the medical evidence here, and you're right to be all over the place, by the way, there isn't a perfect answer because the facts aren't clear. But if the evidence is this, that Kyle can't work with Trevor, but Kyle's otherwise able to work, then the capacity issue connects specifically to Trevor, not the workplace. Okay? That's the same with bullying, isn't it? If you remove Trevor and there's no longer a further risk of Trevor bullying him, then you couldn't go and get an anti-bullying order because the risk of bullying has gone. And that's the idea of a bullying order, is to stop bullying. But here, What we've got is a capacity issue. And the evidence probably that I've given you moves more towards the fact that what prevents Kyle's capacity to work is the presence of Trevor. And there's a case called Kerridge. And for those of you who've worked on Kerridge cases with Kim, who's just brilliant at it, this would be a Kerridge argument. What you'd say is, and you'd have them assessed and you'd get the insurer on board, all difficult things to do, but you'd do it, is to say, look, he only has an incapacity when it's relating to Trevor. He doesn't have an incapacity to be back at work, and the claim would be terminated. And if he chose not to come back to work, then he would have no weekly benefits and there would be no personal leave. It would be a refusal to attend work when he's able to attend work. So I want you to remember with workers' compensation, just when a claim's accepted doesn't mean you turn your brain off. You start thinking about what are the other opportunities. Now, look, we're very close to the end. I must say I really miss Karen. I wish her well in a little operation she's having today, and I hope you all join me in wishing that. But she will be back next week. We will have the survey out around CEOs. And I really look forward to seeing you, and I hope we're all out of lockdown in Victoria, and I hope our New South Wales friends have some greater freedoms by next week. It's just lovely to see you all. Bye-bye.